It's time for Security Now. Steve Gibson is here. Great show ahead for you. We're going to talk about the world's biggest DDoS attack. Unbelievable. TLS 1.3 is coming, and the little certificate authority that couldn't. It's all coming up next on Security Now.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twit.
Bandwidth for Security Now is provided by CashFly at CACHEFLY.com. This is Security Now with Steve Gibson, episode 653, recorded Tuesday, March 6th, 2018. Mem crashed. Security Now is brought to you by FreshBooks, the easy-to-use cloud accounting software for small business owners. Try it free for 30 days at freshbooks.com/securitynow. And by Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. Home plays a big role in your life. That's why Quicken Loans created Rocket Mortgage. It lets you apply simply and understand the entire mortgage process fully so you can be confident you're getting the right mortgage for you. Get started at rocketmortgage.com/securitynow. And by the Ring Video Doorbell. Stop crime before it happens and help make your neighborhood a safer place with Ring. Go to ring.com/securitynow and get up to $150 off a Ring of Security kit. It's time for Security Now, the show where we cover your security and privacy online with this man right here, Mr. Stephen Tiberius Gibson of GRC Corporation.
Hello. Now, wait a minute. This is sounding a little bit like the game show host voice.
Don Pardo speaking. Hello, Steve. I'm excited because we've been talking before the show about something you're going to talk about a little later on.
Yes. In fact, I started by saying I was sorely tempted to name this podcast something, but I won't say for those who – because it would give it away.
Okay.
But for the last couple of weeks, there's been sort of this lull after the whole Spectre and Meltdown Spectre. But not this week. This one was jam-packed with stuff, so much so that for a while I was thinking what I would do, a dual subject, like two main subjects. Then there was, maybe three. Finally I said, no. Let's just focus on the biggie because – this one is titled Security Now 653 Mem Crashed DDoS Attacks.
Oh, this was wild. The biggest DDoS in history.
Yes. Massive. And in fact, the record that was broken 4 days ago was again broken yesterday.
Oh, it's back.
We're now at 1.7 terabits per second.
Is it terabits? Oh, yeah, I guess it's terabits.
Terabits.
Yeah, that'd be crazy.
So, we're gonna talk about this. This one really has the attention of the internet because this is an ELE level event, as they call them, an extinction level event. Ooh. For the internet. This is really bad, and it hasn't even really gotten going yet.
Uh-oh.
This is – and anyway, we will be talking about that. And it uses an – there's never been a service more designed for DDoSing than this. It's called Memcached or Memcached, D as in daemon. It's a service which many Linux systems run. There's a memcached.org where up until a few days ago they were really happy with themselves, tag and value database store that's used for caching. But unfortunately, like so many of these things, it was never supposed to be exposed to the internet. It was only for internal use. Shodan reports 87,800 and some individual exposed instances of this. And so far, we've only seen maybe 5,000 or 6,000 of them in use. So anyway, we'll be talking about that later. even though I'm having a hard time restraining myself, obviously.
I know.
But in the meantime, we're going to talk about some very welcome microcode news from Microsoft, which I sort of gave a hint about possibly happening last week. And the good news is it's really good news. We have 10, yes, 10 new 4G LTE network attacks as a consequence of some researchers who took a good close look at the way our cellular network works and found out it kind of barely does. We had the looming battle over how secure TLS version 1.3 will be allowed to be, following up on our original coverage of this some months ago where we talked about that, and so I'll bring people up to speed on that. We have the incredible Trustico certificate fiasco of the last week, the continually falling usage of Adobe Flash, a new and diabolical cryptocurrency-related malware, the best, and thus the challenge for the title of the show, sci-fi news in a long time, some feedback from our terrific listeners, and then we're going to get into, roll up our sleeves and get into exactly what it is that has really got the internet operators worried as a consequence of it's so easy to perpetrate catastrophically large DDoS attack capability.
Fascinating. And I had never heard that acronym, the ELE. That's interesting.
Yes.
Extinction level event.
Yikes. That's like the large asteroid heading towards us. It's like, oh, well, you know.
It's just extinction we're flirting with.
That's an LE. Yep.
No big deal. Nothing.
Yeah. Don't worry about.
Danger. But first, let's talk.
Now.
First, let's talk about FreshBooks, my friends, the easy-to-use cloud accounting software for small business that I am a big fan of because they saved my butt some years ago, actually quite a few now. When they first started, I was still going up to Canada to do the TV show. And as you remember, Steve, you know, I would go up there a week every month, and then I would have to invoice them for my travel, my hotel, of course, for the work I did, for my day rate. And I had to invoice them in Canadian dollars. And, you know, I hated firing up Microsoft Word and Excel and typing in all the numbers and finding all my receipts. It was a big pain in the butt. So some months I just would, you know, blow it off. I'll invoice them next month. And then the next month would come and I go, you know, I can do it next month. At one point, there was a point where I was 6 months behind on invoices. I finally sent them all at once, and the comptroller said, you can never do this again or you won't get paid. And that was the lesson, by the way. He who does not invoice does not get paid. Amber MacArthur, never forget it, and I thank her eternally for this. She said, there's a new startup in Toronto, you're going to love it, called FreshBooks. And they make it easy to do invoices. And I was immediately a FreshBooks customer. Here we are, fast forward more than a decade later. 10 million customers they have, and they are renowned as being not only the best and easiest way to send out invoices, but really to do all your accounting. If you're a freelancer or a small business, you didn't get into business to do invoices. Well, unless your business is a bookkeeping business, but then you're doing somebody else's invoices. You didn't get into business to do your invoices, but you still got to do them. FreshBooks makes it easy to make professional-looking invoices. And because as soon as you become a FreshBooks customer, you can take credit card payments. And every FreshBooks invoice has a little button that says pay. And by the way, your clients are happy to use it because it makes their life easier. All of a sudden, you'll find with FreshBooks, because you can accept credit cards online, you will get paid an average of twice as fast. Twice as fast. Which for me is a lot faster than never getting paid. So this is amazing. No more chasing clients for payments or, you know, bringing a stack of checks and waiting in line at the bank. You can accept them directly from your invoice, all those credit card payments. You'll always know which invoices have been viewed. That's handy. No more, I didn't get your invoice. Could you send it again? No, you saw it 2 weeks ago. Which invoices have been paid? which invoices are overdue. They make it easy to collect overdue invoices with gentle to angry messages. They got the whole gamut. You can create proposals in FreshBooks. Yeah, I mean, it's much more than just invoicing. Now there's so much stuff. You get these beautiful proposals. It's easy to bill for time by client time and hours, right? Because they have a clock on the page or on their apps. By the way, great apps, Android and iOS. So you can keep track of your hours. They go right into invoices, bill by time, by client or by project, or even by project, different projects for the same client. They're completely every currency they handle. And they also work in many languages. In fact, they just added Spanish and Dutch as options for invoices, estimates, and proposals. Yeah, they do estimates too. With the FreshBooks app, you stay connected to your clients. You keep tabs in your business no matter where you are. You could take a picture of a receipt, upload it, let FreshBooks do the rest. I love that feature. Payment schedules can be set up from the FreshBooks iOS app. You could see attachments on existing proposals. Additional push notifications on iOS. For instance, you'll be notified when a client hasn't viewed an invoice, didn't see it, or when they don't look at your estimate or your proposal within 7 days. Boom. You'll get a ping. You'll get notifications when clients comment, when an invoice becomes overdue. All of this is handled for you automatically. And, you know, taxes soon will be due. Next year, make your life a lot easier with FreshBooks. You don't have to do any bookkeeping. It just happens in the process of keeping track of these invoices and expenses and receivables. And you will know at any given moment whether you're making money, which is something a lot of freelancers, I never knew. Am I making money at this? Am I spending more than I'm making? But you'll also be ready for tax time with all of the reports that you'll need. Automate as much or as little as you want and get back to doing what you love, which is not, I can guarantee you, invoicing. Try FreshBooks now. It's free for 30 days. FreshBooks.com/security now. FreshBooks.com/security now. If you do us a favor and write security now in when they ask how you heard about us, that'd be very nice of you. FreshBooks.com/security now. We thank FreshBooks for making it possible to do this very Security Now show.
You know, I was listening and you were talking about getting paid twice as fast. And I thought, well, if you were never invoicing before,
you're getting paid zero.
Infinitely.
Zero is, yes.
You're being paid infinitely faster.
Yeah,
infinitely.
That's the mathematician in you there.
That's right.
Exactly.
Just don't divide by zero. You're in trouble then. So, okay, I've got really good news for everybody. Really good news. Microsoft has decided to step up and take responsibility for the Intel processor microcode themselves. I mentioned last week that
instead of Intel or?
Well, okay, so Intel's doing the microcode, but all of the advice had been necessarily to go get the update, the BIOS update from your system supplier. That's not going to be necessary.
Hallelujah.
Yes. I mentioned last week that there were two DLLs in the Windows System 32 directory, which were Intel and AMD microcode patch files that Windows had the capability, much as Linux does, to perform an on-the-fly boot time update of Intel and AMD processor microcode and has in the past. The question was, would they do that here? And it's difficult to imagine they would not, because of the nature of our supply chain, being as fragmented and unreliable as it is with BIOSes, they need to get microcode into their systems. So they have released the first of a growing family of updates. It's not being pushed out, at least for the time being, through the regular Windows update channel, and it's not clear whether it ever will be. Maybe they just want it to have it be on demand for the time being. If you Google, and here's the knowledge base number, if you want to Google KB4090 007, That's, I think, the easiest way to recognize that is 4090007.
Warning, warning, danger, danger. What is that sound? Yeah.
4090007. That will take you to Microsoft's announcement of what they currently support. At this moment, they're supporting only a couple of their Skylake processors, probably because that's the strongest, most secure firmware that's known to be, rock solid. They're both sixth generation Intel Core processors. And only Windows 10 version 1709, meaning the very latest Fall Creators Update version of Windows 10, both on x86 and AMD platform. So both 32 and 64, but only these. It's a small handful. It's like two different processors that have a couple different names. No word on Windows 7 or 8.1. Although I did read some coverage of this suggesting that Windows 7 was going to still be supported within the window that would cause this to be expected to be supported. So there's hope that there will be updates for Windows 7, which will also be able to do this. What I'm going to do, because this is tied to hard to determine processor specifics, you know, like what I have on Skylake, I think, but I don't know which one, and there's like a bunch of them. I'm going to give Inspector, my little tool, a rev in the next couple days. It won't take long to show the processor ID, the internal processor code, which Microsoft uses and Intel uses, but which is not otherwise readily available, as far as I know, anywhere in the user interface. And that will allow people to see which one they've got and then check this table as it evolves to see whether they've got support. So what this means is that right now, for people with the supported Skylake processors who also are on the latest Fall Creators Update of Windows 10, whether you've got Intel or AMD, whether you've got 32 or 64, AMD technically is the architecture of the 64. So Skylake processors from Intel, either 32 or 64-bit versions of Windows 10, you can get this and add it to your Windows 10. And even if you do not have an updated BIOS from your system manufacturer, this will patch that the one most problematical Spectre problem, which is that variant 2 of the Spectre vulnerability, and then you'll be good to go. And what we expect is, as Intel is able to mature and confirm other microcode releases, and it goes through whatever vetting Microsoft gives it, then this list will expand both in terms of supported platforms, and also because, for example, they did support the Meltdown under Windows 7 almost immediately. So, you know, they're intending to mitigate these vulnerabilities on probably from 7, 8.1, and 10, but then also for other processor architectures as they become available. And as I said, I'll rev Inspector just to add a little bit of information about the availability of this for people who show that their system is still vulnerable to the Spectre problem, and then also to reveal the processor ID, the CPU ID, which Intel and Microsoft are referencing in these documents, to see whether they qualify yet, and that maybe, we don't know, maybe Microsoft will end up pushing this out. But if anyone wants to get it beforehand, I'm sure after everything we've gone through so far this year, Microsoft is not making this available until they're sure that they've got it nailed. So again, it's you can just Google KB4090007, and that'll take you to the Knowledge Base article that's so got links.
So I had a caller on the Sunday on the radio show. I felt really bad for her. She had a Asus gaming machine she had built, and there was a 4-year-old Asus motherboard, and they're right. probably never going to patch that. This would be in lieu of that, right? It won't be for her because this is obviously not going to be a Skylake machine. But if they do this for other processors, that would be enough.
Yes.
You don't need a BIOS update. In other words, you just need this microcode update that Microsoft's going to actually provide.
Right.
Are they providing Intel's fix?
Yes, they're getting this from Intel. Okay. So Intel provides it to them. And so the way you can think about this is that the processor comes with microcode, which when it powers up, it copies microcode in an internal ROM into RAM for lightning speed access. So it's like there's an internal microcode RAM store. So that can be overwritten. Microcode can be patched by something that has the privilege to do so when the system starts up. That's what BIOSes do when they've got updates to the microcode. So when like Lenovo, you know, patched various systems, Dell had a patch for some laptops. So the BIOS can contain that patch, and then the BIOS is able to say to the processor, oh, I've got some updates for your microcode. And so every time it boots, the processor initially puts the microcode in that it has, but then the BIOS is able to say, we got some fixes. And so it rewrites a little bit of the microcode in the chip, which then the chip uses for the rest of the duration of it being powered on. But that doesn't have to only be done by the BIOS. The OS can do it too. And Linux has the ability to do that. And in fact, earlier, Intel published a file that Linux users could use to patch themselves immediately. They then withdrew it when they realized they'd had problems with the patches. And I don't know if it's been reissued yet by Intel for Linux. But Microsoft can do it too. And so this is the beginning of that. So with additional processors going forward, what this essentially means is it will absolutely not be necessary if you have Windows 10 Fall Creators Update. We don't know for sure how far back they're going to go. I was trying to get some clear sense for that, and Microsoft isn't saying, but those who seem to know believe ultimately we'll get, you know, all of the supported OSs will get coverage. And really, there's no reason for them not to. It's a simple thing to do if you're doing it for one OS. It's just basically it's a couple DLLs. The patch, they're less than a meg. They're 773K or something, you know, because it's not a lot of, you know, it's micro after all. So anyway, that's great news. And so for this caller who you spoke to, for example, if she's got an OS that Microsoft is supporting, then either by going and manually getting it, maybe automatically having it pushed, it's not clear yet, but at least right now they are making it available for some users of Skylake.
That's good. That'll help a lot of people. Probably not her, but it'll help a lot of people. That's good. Yeah.
There was about a year and a half ago, a group of researchers, two guys at the State University of New York in Binghamton and another at UC Riverside, developed a side channel attack on branch target buffer collisions. It's closely related to everything we've been talking about with this Spectre problem. That is, this branch target buffer is a cache that saves on computation and speed. So that was a year and a half ago. I was reminded of it, and the thing that's significant to me, and I knew this graph when I saw this graph, I thought, oh, Leo's going to love this one. On the next page of the show notes, Leo, is a chart showing the timing of using this speculative execution branch prediction when they get a hit versus when they get misses. And it's just it's beautiful, because what they're doing with this attack 18 months ago is they're essentially managing to remove address space layout randomization. So you've got that on the screen now. You can see along the bottom, they are trying different groups of high order bits for where something is located, and you can see the one that they score on is, you know, so there's sort of a statistical distribution. It's noisy all over, but it ranges from like about 45 cycles to maybe 65. But when they hit it, it's suddenly a little over 90, and just one just sitting out there all by itself, which says, okay, you know, bang, we had the collision that we were looking for. Anyway, there's really no other news here, but I just love this graphic that was in their PDF, because it demonstrates the sort of thing that we see when we get one of these statistical, timing-based results, is the amount of time that something takes changes dramatically. And in this case, with this research, they were able to, in 60 milliseconds, completely strip all address space layout randomization, either from another user process or from the kernel. So, you know, these sorts of attacks have been around for a while, and they, as we know, of course, it's been most of the news of the year so far has been about this. But I just really like that chart, because we hadn't seen something as clear in the previous coverage of that. So, three researchers from Purdue University and one at the University of Iowa took a good, hard, long look at our current 4G LTE network protocol. They developed a tool they called the LTE Inspector to essentially more closely examine the protocol we're all using. All of our cellular 4G LTE network is based on this. In the abstract for their paper, they wrote, in this paper, we investigate the security and privacy of the three critical procedures of the 4G LTE protocol: attach, detach, and paging, which are internal, names for specific actions in the protocol. They said, and in the process, uncover potential design flaws of the protocol and unsafe practices employed by the stakeholders. For exposing vulnerabilities, we propose a model-based testing approach. And then they introduce LTE Inspector, which combines a symbolic model checker and a cryptographic protocol verifier in what they call the symbolic attacker model. So basically, they modeled the protocol in this LTE Inspector and then ran it through its paces looking for problems. They say, using LTE Inspector, we have uncovered 10 new attacks, along with 9 prior attacks, categorized into 3 abstract classes: security, user privacy, and disruption of service. In the 3 procedures of that is these 3: attach, detach, and paging of the 4G LTE protocol. Notable among our findings is the authentication relay attack that enables an adversary to spoof the location of a legitimate user to the core network without possessing appropriate credentials, to ensure that the exposed attacks pose real threats and are indeed realizable in practice. We have validated 8 of the 10 new attacks. and their accompanying adversarial assumptions through experimentation in a real test bed. So anyway, what we have here is, you know, the kind of vetting that we – it's easy to wish afterwards that this had happened beforehand, but – these protocols evolve sort of organically. Things get tacked on. Somebody, you know, a committee says, oh, let's add this feature or that feature. And at first blush, it looks fine. Unfortunately, it turns out when you really, really look closely, they've become so complex that it is difficult to make any true security assertions, and it takes careful modeling of the protocol and then a deliberate attack of that on that model in order to find problems. So, you know, they stop short, they deliberately stop short of publishing any proof of concept code because they don't want to make it that easy. They argue that it's difficult to see how this can be fixed through further patching. I love their language somewhere. They said, we deliberately do not discuss defenses for the observed attacks as retrospectively adding security to an existing protocol without breaking backward compatibility often yields Band-Aid-like solutions which do not hold up under scrutiny. Meaning, you know, it may be difficult, if not impossible, to fix this. So what we have is a better sense than we had before. You know, we've talked about problems with our cellular communications, the whole problem with the signaling system, which is old now and never had authentication built into it. Well, we've been trying to move the system forward and essentially go back and shore it up a little bit with, as this demonstrates, some mixed results. So what this probably means is that we need to more carefully recognize that the security of the transfer protocol, the security of the transit protocol, cannot be relied on, and so things like signal and telegram and messenger, you know, encrypted protocols that run on top of this questionable transport protocol is what we need to rely on going forward, which would argue for having stronger encryption and security for the protocols that we use on top of this 4G LTE and future cellular protocols. They also note, for example, that faking things like emergency alerts of the kind which caused the hysteria in Hawaii earlier this year, although of course we know that one was a human error. Some guy pushed the button next to the one he meant to push.
No,
but still,
they found out he was.
Oh,
he misunderstood the.
deliberately pushed the wrong one.
He received an alert said this is a drill, and then this is a drill, and he wasn't paying attention. And he pushed the alert button.
So he just didn't hear the
he
this is a drill part.
Understand that this is a drill part. He no longer works there.
Yeah. And you always wonder, you know, in the movies where they say this is not a drill.
Right.
Well, okay, well.
It sure sounds like a drill.
If it is a drill and they don't say that, then you know it's a drill, right? So that never made any sense to me. It's like, you know, here's an alert and we're serious this time. Before, you know, until now, we haven't been that serious. But this time, really,
this time we mean it.
Please pay attention.
Please.
This is not a drill.
Not a drill.
On the other hand, if it was a drill and that you wanted to actually drill people, that's what you'd say too. You know? So I don't know. It just never seemed to make much sense to me.
Yeah. Yeah.
So Okay, speaking of what's not making much sense, well, although I guess I can understand this, we've seen over and over and over how difficult it is to move security forward, and especially to retire things that have long since had better solutions. We talked some months ago about the next version of TLS, the Transport Layer Security. TLS is the new name for what we used to call SSL, and you know, SSL 1 and 2 and 3 and lots of subversions, and now we're up, and now, you know, 3.0 of SSL was sort of TLS version 1.0. There was sort of a transition that we made. Well, 1.2 was ratified in 2008, so 8 years ago, and we're just now to the point where we're beginning to get ready to say, okay, you know, we're absolutely going to depend upon that. But as is always the case, we're wanting to have the next version ready, and so that support can begin to get created for it. And that will be version 1.3. The 1.3 is many good things, and we'll go over it in detail. I'm sure that there will be a podcast whose title is TLS version 1.3 when it happens, when it finally gets ratified, because it hasn't yet. And so they're still arguing over the details and over the features. Overall, it's really a good thing. I'm excited about it because it follows the KISS principle, you know, keep it simple. And also, a protocol should be as simple as possible, but not simpler. So what 1.3 does is deliberately abandon a bunch of old junk which has been hung on and tagging along and supported just because it once seemed like a good idea. We long since learned otherwise, but it's still kind of there. So it's like, okay, no more of this old baggage. This is the baggage removal version of TLS, which is all for the good. But the big controversy, and this is what we discussed before, is that it provides for the first time, and it's a little surprising to people that we didn't already have this, but it provides for the first time what's known as forward secrecy, sometimes perfect forward secrecy, PFS. What that means is that conversations which are encrypted, as they are under TLS, cannot be later decrypted if in the future something is discovered. Believe it or not, we don't have that today. Even with TLS version 1.2, as we've discussed in the past, the part of the secret of the key which is negotiated on the fly is the server's private key. That's felt to be safe because it's private and servers have a huge stake in keeping it private. So what happens is right now, up until 1.3, if the NSA, just to pick on somebody, and of course they do have a massive data center in Utah with its own power, power and cooling lakes and massive, God knows how much storage, if all of the traffic everywhere were just siphoned into this monster facility and stored, even though they can't see it because it's encrypted, right? But if the handshake of TLS up to version 1.2 is recorded, and if at any time in the future, even after the server's private key expires, if at any time in the future a the private key of the server, which was in use at the time, is disclosed, is found, is discovered, or maybe quantumness happens in the future. And so it's you can get it somehow. Who knows? It's possible to take the private key and the handshake observed and obtain the session key, which is what is used to encrypt the conversation. So that's no forward secrecy. TLS version 1.3 is bringing us forward secrecy, which is a huge improvement. I mean, that's good news. The problem is, and this is what we discussed about this before, it's facing some backlash because there have been some ways that data centers have used the lack of that forward secrecy to, with, for example, with to terminate TLS version up to 1.2 connections at their border so that inside the data center, the traffic is not encrypted. That is, so they've got something on their edge which clients connect to as a proxy, essentially, a proxy for the servers. And then inside the data center, everything's in the clear. So that's been a convenience for network guys who are then able to monitor traffic, intrusion detection easily, see what's going on. You know, they have complete visibility into the traffic. Essentially, in their data center, nothing is encrypted, which makes people nervous, but makes the network guys happy because they're able to just to see everything, which is convenient. It turns out that the coming late to this is what's known as BITS, B-I-T-S, which is the technology policy decision of the Financial Services Roundtable, which is the industry group for financial services in the U.S. You know, all the banks and other high-end financial groups have this roundtable group that they're members of, and these guys are like suddenly woke up to the fact that, oh my God, this might happen, and we don't want to spend any money on our data centers, essentially is what this comes down to. They're fighting it just because they'll have to do something. They'll have to invest in more security, essentially, in order to work around what this means. So there's been some, and this is where it's coming down to some push for a mode for TLS version 1.3 that would not be forward secret. And the people who want forward secrecy, like everybody else, the people who care about secrecy and security, are saying, no, if we make this be a bit you can flip, or if you can have a downgrade to pre 1.3 forward secrecy, then that's what people are going to do or use. And so, for example, what that would mean is that the banking industry, where you might argue it would be important to have forward secrecy, in order to save themselves the trouble of changing anything in support of TLS version 1.3, they will refuse that mode during negotiation, which means all of the public traffic with those organizations will lack forward secrecy, which arguably is probably where you need a lot of it. So anyway, this battle is looming. I just sort of wanted to touch on this because the final ratification meeting with the IETF is supposed to occur later this month. The purists are absolutely refusing any compromise, saying, as I said, that if there's a way to not do it, those who don't want to invest in what it takes on their side will set that bit. I mean, it's not like right now anyone has to use it. You know, I mean, it's not even born yet. But and so, you know, we'll be with 1.2 for a long time. At some point, for example, 1.0 and 1.1 is now old enough, since 1.2 has been around for 8 years, that they're on the way toward being deprecated. I received a note, for example, from my back end that I do e-commerce with, the financial clearinghouse that my own e-commerce system interacts with, just a day or two ago, an alert that this summer they are going to stop supporting TLS version 1.0 and 1.1. And so make sure that your infrastructure supports 1.2. Mine does. And so this is an example of what's happening. Someday 1.2 will be phased out once 1.3 has been well enough established, probably not for 8 years. So again, you know, if it follows the same time course as it might, because of course 1.2 is very good. We fixed a lot of the problems in 1.0 and 1.1. So we're pretty happy at 1.2 for now, but ultimately, we'll be going to 1.3. What these guys want is for 1.3 to be the, you know, useful, to be the right thing to move to, and not to have pre-crippled it because some people who are saying, "Oh, we're going to have to buy some more wires," are being too cheap to do that. So, I'm expecting this is going to happen without the weakening provision. Interestingly, Matthew Green was one of the people who was trying to find a compromise and was rebuffed by the committee, saying, "You know, thanks, but you know, we're really going to try to stick with this and get this thing to pass through the IETF as an all or nothing, and in this case, as an all for encryption, so that it isn't weakened ahead of time." And Leo, I'm going to take a sip of coffee.
I think that's a good thought. And while you take a sip of coffee, I will tell everybody, I will shout it from the rooftops about Rocket Mortgage, our sponsor. Actually, there is really good news. Quicken Loans, which, you know, is the company behind Rocket Mortgage, and there's an interesting story there, which I'll tell you in a second. I just found out, is now the number one lender in the country. I've always said they're number one in customer satisfaction, 8 years in a row, in fact, according to J.D. Power. But they're now literally number one, the biggest lender in the country. Big does not mean bad, though. I mean, the people they lapped weren't so good. And that's one of the reasons I think Quicken Loans is on top right now. I'll tell you the other reason, Rocket Mortgage. Quicken Loans realized that the old way of originating mortgages, of the loan approval process, was really literally the old way, where you go to a bank and you fill out a long application in triplicate, and then you go home, wait to hear, and while you're waiting, you have to go to the attic and find a bunch of paperwork like pay stubs and bank statements. And of course, I never had any of the bank statements, so I had to call the bank and they weren't online anymore and say, "Hey, can I get my bank statement from 5 years ago? The bank wants it, blah, 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 blah." Last time we bought a house 4 years ago, it literally took 2 months. It was ridiculous. We were on vacation and we were still faxing them stuff. Well, Quicken Loans got to be the biggest lender in the nation because they know a thing or two about customers and about customer satisfaction. And they realized that the loan approval process was stuck in the 19th century. It needed a kind of a client-focused technological revolution. So they created Rocket Mortgage. So step one, you don't go to the bank. You don't have to put on a tie. You don't have to fill out an application. You just go to rocketmortgage.com/securitynow, answer a few simple questions, give them permission to contact, you know, they have relationships with all the financial institutions, so you give them permission to contact those financial institutions. They pull, you know, the information they need. They crunch the numbers based on income, based on assets, and based on credit. They pick the loans that are right for you. You choose the term, the rate, the down payment, and you're done. And this whole thing took, no, not months, not weeks, not days, literally minutes. You could do it while you're in the bathtub. You could do it during a commercial break on Security Now. It's that fast. RocketMortgage.com/Security Now. When you go to that open house, bring your phone with you so you can apply. We should buy this house. Okay. A couple of minutes later, we're approved. We'd like to make an offer. That's how easy it is. Refinancing, too, by the way. And now is a very good time to refinance. Interest rates. We already know interest rates are going up. Lock in a low interest rate now. RocketMortgage.com/security now. Equal housing lender licensed in all 50 states. NMLSConsumerAccess.org, number 3030. We thank them so much for their support of Security Now. RocketMortgage.com/security now. And congratulations to Quicken Loans, the number one lender in the good old U.S. of A. Okay.
So...
You know, a lot of times you heave that sigh on this show, and I know something's coming, something not good.
Yeah. So there's a UK, or maybe was, I'm not sure if this company's going to survive this, a UK-based reseller of Symantec certificates. So purporting to be a certificate authority, they didn't have their own CA infrastructure. Because of course that's a big deal. To run a CA, you've got to have really good network. You got to have to really be serious about security. There's all kinds of ways you can screw up. So you have to not do that. But you need to have, for example, run certificate revocation services and have those up and available and reliable. And, there's a lot to it. So it's easier for a company to say, as Trustico did some time ago back to Symantec, hey, we'd like to be a reseller of your certificates. So, you go to Trustico and you say, hey there, folks, I want to I'm in the UK too, and so are you. So I want to get a certificate from you. And they say, we'd be happy to sell you a certificate. What they're actually doing is selling them a Symantec certificate with Trustico sort of as the front end. So it's much easier to resell than it is to actually be a CA. So the problem, of course, is that as we know, Symantec screwed up actually with some of their partners, kind of like Trustico. And so Symantec's certificates are going to be declined in the future because we can't really be sure what's what with them. So as a consequence, that impacted Symantec. And as we've covered on the podcast, Symantec looked around for somebody reliable and trusted that they could sell their certificate customer base to, essentially. And that turned out to be my favorite certificate company, DigiCert. So maybe as part of this, in some sort of an awkward way, Trustico decided, and some of this is not clear. I read a bunch of coverage about this, trying to really put the timeline together. But Trustico decided they didn't want to stay with Symantec / DigiCert. They wanted to go to another shining gem, Komodo. So they sent a letter to DigiCert, Trustico did, saying, we want you to revoke 50,000 certificates.
And we know how well certificate revocation works.
Yeah, yes. Thank you for that, Leo. Exactly. I dragged our listeners through my fury over certificate revocation some years ago, which, of course, is completely broken, especially for Chrome, which doesn't really even try. So DigiCert says, what? We're not even sure you as a not even quite a CA yourself can ask us to revoke certificates on behalf of your customers. They're your customers. It's up to them if there's a problem with the certificate to say, hey, whoops, we think we lost control of our private key. We need you to revoke the certificate, please. So DigiCert says, yeah, what? No. The only possible way we could revoke certificates is if there was a clear breach of their private key. Whereupon some jamoke at Trustico zips and emails DigiCert some 23,000 private keys.
No.
It's unbelievable. So wait a minute. So not only did they zip them up and email them.
I hope they put a password on the zip.
No, they were non-password protected private keys, as a matter of fact.
Oh, my God.
Not only that.
That's one way to get them revoked.
But they shouldn't have ever had them. A CA should never have your private key. The private key. When I have DigiCert sign a key, they're signing my public key. So the server, a GRC server, makes a public key pair consisting of a private key, which never leaves its control, and the public key. The public key is what is going to be sent out with every TLS connection. That's the thing that you want the CA to sign so that when the client, the browser, receives the public key, it looks at the signature and goes, oh, this is signed by DigiCert. I like them. And therefore, I'm going to trust the public key. The point is, DigiCert never gets my private key. They don't want it. I mean, nobody wants the responsibility. Somehow, Trustico had the private keys of its customers.
It was a convenience thing.
Well, get a load of this. It turns out that they, for convenience, they had a web page where if their customers were, for whatever reason, unable to generate a key pair themselves, Trustico, handy dandy Trustico, would do it for them. So, and yes, Leo did it in JavaScript with JavaScript from five or six different sources, including ads on the same page. So nothing has ever been less secure.
Oh,
I mean, you can't make this up. This is just, as I said.
Actually, your picture of the week might have something to do with this. There may be, perhaps there is a less secure way to store private keys. What do you think?
Yes. The picture of the week is just so perfect. This was somebody's response to this debacle, which is just wonderful. It shows some cheesy liquor cabinet. I mean, there's a screw top bottle of red wine on the left
and
some Band-Aids just because in case you've had too much to drink and you slip and cut yourself, and some dry gin and a half consumed flask of whiskey. I mean, and then that's on the lower shelf. On the upper shelf, there's this beaten up box that says #, Trustico, and then in big capital letters, private keys, please do not open. Yes, we've stored all of our customers' private keys in this box whose lid is sort of damaged too. I mean, this is just amazing. So no one can believe this. This is just incredible that they would, first of all, have private keys. Then when challenged by DigiCert, correctly quoting the terms of the CAB, the certificate authority group, the cab forum, saying, what do you mean revoke 50,000 certificates? Now, man, and remember, these were not the certificates that DigiCert ever issued. Symantec issued them, and they sort of inherited them as a part, as a consequence of the Symantec acquisition. So it's like, what? So they say, here's a bunch of private keys. They're disclosed now, sucker. So it's like, oh, now DigiCert isn't quite sure what to do about the other 27,000 that have not yet been received in email. So there's that problem. So as part of this, DigiCert doing the right thing, posted to a common forum that they all use about like what was going on. This is the Mozilla security mailing list. Scott Helm, who's an information security consultant and an expert in the CA domain, was quoted in some of the coverage saying, to arrive at the conclusion that Trustico have been anything other than grossly negligent here is rather difficult. Generation, storage, and the apparent ease and willingness to further compromise the keys are all outrageously inappropriate. They could have trivially proven ownership of those keys without the need to zip 24K plus of them and send them via email. If these actions were motivated by business/politics, as some suggest, it'd be ironic if their actions resulted in their removal as a reseller. And indeed, it's difficult to imagine how even Komodo could say, yeah, at this point, we'd love to have your reseller business. I mean, yikes. DigiCert reported the revocation incident on the Mozilla security mailing list, which we've quoted from time to time. It's often used to discuss affairs of the CA browser forum. And not surprisingly, members of the mailing list had concerns regarding Trustico's access to the private keys. Eric Mill, who's the senior advisor at the U.S. General Services Administration's Technology Transformation Service, posted, quote, Trustico doesn't seem to provide any hosting or CDN services that would make use of the private key, nor do they appear to explicitly inform users about the storage of this private key, thus suggesting that there was no apparent reason for Trustico to keep copies of the private keys. Eric also wrote, the storage of private keys appears to be done without the user's knowledge or consent. Given everything that's known, then regardless of who emailed whose customers, when and why, I think it's clear that Trustico compromised those keys and has been routinely compromising customer keys for years. Given that there's no evidence that Trustico indicated any intent to change their business practices, then I believe it's appropriate for all CAs to immediately suspend or terminate their relationship with Trustico, Eric added. So anyway, DigiCert, of course, was in the middle of this because they were the inheritor, essentially, of the certificates which were originally issued by Symantec via Trustico. So they said, Trustico, this is DigiCert, said, today DigiCert issued the following statement regarding Trustico certificate revocation. Trustico requested revocation of their Symantec, GeoTrust, Thought, and Rapid SSL certificates. Okay, so that I forgot to cover that. They were getting more of them than just from Symantec, claiming the certificates were compromised. When we asked for proof of the, quote, compromise, unquote, Trustico did not provide details on why they were requesting the immediate revocation. And remember, this is $50,000. Trustico's CEO indicated that Trustico held the private keys for those certificates and then emailed us approximately 20,000 certificate private keys. When he sent us those keys, his action gave us no choice but to act in accordance with the CA browser forum baseline requirements, which mandate that we revoke a compromised certificate within 24 hours. As a CA, we had no choice but to follow the baseline requirements. Following our standard revocation process, we gave notice via email to each certificate holder whose private keys had been exposed to us by Trustico so they could have time to get a replacement certificate. I imagine there's some scrambling going on at the moment. The DigiCert's announcement continues. In communications today, Trustico has suggested that this revocation is due to the upcoming Google Chrome distrust of Symantec Roots. That is incorrect, DigiCert writes. We want to make it clear that the certificates needed to be revoked because Trustico sent us the private keys. This has nothing to do with future potential distrust dates. And then they conclude, the upcoming Chrome distrust situation is entirely separate. We are working closely to help customers with certificates affected by the browser distrust, and we are offering free replacement certificates through their existing customer portals. That process is well underway. So, as I said, yes, Leo, a heavy sigh at the beginning of this one. This is just, you know, bizarre. And I don't know anything about Trustico.
What's the vetting process at setting up a CA? I mean, presumably McAfee had the responsibility to vet these guys, or Symantec. But doesn't ICANN put something in place? these guys were clowns, obviously.
They were clowns, and I mean to be minting public key pairs in JavaScript
on a public page,
on a public page with JavaScript hosted from five or six other domains, including ads, is unconscionable. I mean, it boggles the mind. Yet they were doing it until, I mean, the thought I had, and this is following up on your question, is you would imagine that there would be some obligation that Symantec would have had to vet the ongoing conduct of their reseller. But on the other hand, it is due to the conduct of a different reseller that Symantec lost their whole CA business in the first place.
Yeah, they obviously didn't
care. Let this be a lesson to other CAs who are essentially extending their trust into third parties by allowing those third parties to resell their certificates. This is what that looks like when it goes sideways, you know, first with Symantec and then with this other reseller. Again, this makes Symantec look even worse than they already did, because this was the conduct of another one of their resellers. Wow. So with any luck, Trustico is gone, because this will get enough coverage and enough people will realize, you know, I don't care how cheap these certs are. I got to run around in circles and worry about being compromised. And now I've got to, you know, come up with replacement certificates within 24 hours because not that revocation is going to have any effect. Oh, I forgot to mention that DigiCert will be providing the keys to the members of the browser community, so that, for example, browsers like Chrome, if it chooses to, and or Firefox and others, could blacklist those certs. And there's been some discussion of proactively blacklisting them, which is a pain in the butt because this is no small
done by hand,
number,
right?
I mean, yeah, it's no small number of certs to mm-hmm. to have to deal with. What a mess! Mm. Incredible mess. A little bit of good news. Flash usage, Adobe Flash usage has declined from 80% in 2014 to under 8% today. There was a keynote speech given by in San Diego last week, given by Google's director of engineering at the Network and Distributed System Security Symposium. Her keynote, among other things, showed a slide that I've got here on the next page of the show notes, in case you want to put it up on the screen, Leo, yeah, showing flash usage decline from around 80% in mid-2014 down to about 8% today. And it's to call it precipitous is unfortunately, it looks a little bit like Bitcoin valuation, too. So anyway, what they did was they looked at the percentage of daily Chrome users who've loaded at least one page containing Flash content per day. And that by that, so that's the metric. Full-time Chrome users probably who encounter Flash at least once per day has dropped from around 80% 4 years ago to 8% today. And of course, as we've previously covered, Adobe has announced they're formally planning to give up on Flash. It's funny, I've seen by the end of 2020, but I also saw, by December 2020 is when they're saying, okay, no more. So only a few more years, and it's really, really gone. On the other hand, its usage has gone from, in the various browsers, Chrome, Firefox, and Edge, from what you might call, enabled or enabled and pray to click if you dare. So it is now... It no longer runs by default. You have to say, oh, yes, I want to do this, whatever it is that Flash is asking. So, I mean, we are seeing updates. I was watching a system update just yesterday. I think it was a Win 10 machine. And it's, Adobe Flash update. It's like, oh, okay, well, fine. At least it's not going to just launch. It's going to say, hey, wait, whoops, hold on. Do you want to do this? So that certainly mitigates a lot of the advertising-based and drive-by Flash, Adobe Flash attacks that we've seen in the past. And of course, HTML5 can now play video, and most advertising networks and video streaming portals have already moved away from Flash plugins to pure browser-based HTML5. So, it gives an improved user experience. So anyway, someday it will just be a memory. And a long lesson in what can go wrong with the security of a plugin back from when it was necessary. Okay, and this is crazy, but I'm sure we ran across a story like this in the past. There's something that Palo Alto Networks has a piece of malware that they've named Combo Jack. They named it Combo Jack because it hijacks the system clipboard, watching for a valid cryptocurrency address to be pasted into the clipboard, and then replaces that address with one of its own on the fly. So that's the jack part, the hijack part. The combo part is that, believe it or not, it can differentiate and detect the individual address formats for Bitcoin, Litecoin, Ethereum, Monero, Kiwi, Yandex Money, and two versions of Web Money, both denominated in U.S. dollars and in rubles. So if you're infected by this thing and you are wanting to send somebody money, right? They email you their cryptocurrency address, or there's a donate to cryptocurrency address on a web page, and you're feeling beneficent. So you say, okay, fine. So you, of course, you're not going to do that, transcribe it by hand. So you mark it with your cursor, you know, you highlight it, and you hit Control C to copy it, or whatever you do, right click and get a context menu and say copy. Well, that puts it on the clipboard. This thing, crypto or combo jack, is watching. It sees the clipboard suddenly containing a cryptocurrency address, which it recognizes, it parses it and recognizes it, because it turns out they're all a little bit different, enough different that they can be disambiguated. And it has its own accounts for all of those cryptocurrencies. So it immediately replaces it with its own. Now you go to your whatever it is, wallet or wherever you go to send some of your cryptocurrency to that cryptocurrency, never really paying attention to the fact that, because, I mean, you know, everyone glosses over those crypto-looking things. You know, you're not memorizing this thing that you just copied off the web page. So then you paste it into your cryptocurrency payment app and say, here, send them some money. Well, apparently this scheme is working. It isn't easy to get it into your system, or at least, it's a long and involved exploit chain, but it's an exploit chain that we've actually seen before. You receive an email containing a PDF. You open the PDF. Oh, and this particular PDF says it's the scan of a lost passport. So that seems like
Looking for that. Oh,
yeah.
Send me that email.
Seems like a bit of a stretch. You know, it's like, wait a minute, I didn't lose a passport. Then you're just going to delete the email. But, you know, it's more like, you know, like the scan of the traffic ticket that you received last week, the e-ticket or something. That seems more likely to get somebody.
Your tickets
are
here. Your flight to Paris.
Right. That's right.
There you go.
Yeah.
I'm opening that one.
So you open the PDF. It opens an RTF file that it contains, a rich text format file, which in turn contains an embedded HTA object, which attempts to exploit a known DirectX vulnerability, which then executes a series of PowerShell commands to download and execute a password-protected self-extracting SFX file, which then installs Combo Jack.
That's unfortunately
this is how circuitous this route is to get this thing installed in your machine, but it's happening. It's been found on people's machines. They're thinking, what lost passport? And then before they know it, they just can't help themselves. They need to take a look at it to see whose lost passport it is. And then bang, if they attempt to send cryptocurrency to anybody, it ends up going to the bad guys. So seems like a hard way to make money, but, you know, cryptocurrency is the thing now. Two more things, then we'll do our last break and then talk about memcrashed, as it's being called. So, Leo, I was 10 years old in 1965.
10 years old.
Having been born in 1955.
Just a kid.
And I guess you were, what, 8 probably?
Yeah,
I think you're
56, so.
So
yeah.
What happened is that the phrase "Danger, Will Robinson" entered
Danger, later. Danger.
I mean, it's incredible when you think about it. Who, I mean, Danger, Will Robinson, that's just a thing now. I mean, it's a meme. It's yeah. And the other thing I realized was does not compute. I don't think that Lost in Space was the first time we saw the robot waving its
does
its,
not compute.
Its rubber, you know, its accordion arms around, but it certainly does not compute became another meme.
Is that where
but
that
Danger,
started? That's amazing. I bet you're right.
I think so.
Yeah.
Yeah. And so
I was
Danger,
programmed for more important work.
Sorry. Was probably asked him for the recipe for a souffle or something.
Yes, yeah, probably.
Warning, warning, warning.
Oh, Lord, yes.
My childhood is coming right back to me.
So I'm mentioning this because on Friday the 13th, April, next month, Netflix releases a 10-episode, what looks like a fantastic reboot of Lost in Space. There was, what, maybe, how long ago was it? The feature-length movie?
Yeah, that's wasn't, right.
Wasn't it great. Wasn't that good. Yeah. I mean, I watched it, of course, but it was, you know, it was okay, but not great. This looks wonderful. There's a 3-minute trailer for Netflix's forthcoming Lost in Space series. I will urge any sci-fi lovers in the audience to go find it. I've got the link here in the show notes. It's just shy of 3 minutes long. You will know that you're going to want to be, I will be metering those 10 episodes out over the weekend. Luckily,
silence,
Lori,
you mental midget.
Luckily, Lori loves this kind of stuff as much as I do. Yeah, so we will be sitting side by side, glued to the screen, probably in 2 5-hour
chunks,
bursts,
big chunks.
I expect Friday
Howard,
night and Saturday.
Hey, it's working great.
I have a bunch of those.
Oh, and Leo, I remember at 10 years old being terrified. My sister, who is also 2 years younger, we sort of had our heads buried in our pillows, peering out over them. You know,
oh, yeah.
As you know, as like the salad
the ice cream
monster.
Cone monsters, yes,
exactly. The salad monster comes out from behind a rock and is like, "Oh my god!" Anyway, there are no salad
my
monsters.
My micromechanism thanks you. My computer tapes thank you, and I thank you.
It is not. Is it a comedy? Because that was kind of a comedy. This looks pretty.
No,
serious.
No.
What a
this
good-looking
looks...
robot, man. That's a nice robot.
Oh, it's a beautiful robot.
Yeah,
Maybe you should. It's only 3 minutes. Let's go ahead. Even though our listeners who are only listening will only hear the audio, you'll get a sense for it.
It's dramatic.
Let's run it into the podcast.
So this is the ship, the Robinson family. Is on the ship, and they are now stranded on a planet. And there's the little Will Robinson, who's exploring the planet for the first time.
Doesn't but look... I mean, beautiful special effects.
Yeah, really, it looks
I mean,
nicely
this is,
done.
This
yeah.
is world-class sci-fi.
Lost. No kidding.
There's Penny.
This is Will Robinson of the 24th Colonist Group. I'm the first human to discover evidence. Of an alien intelligence.
Oh, so the robot isn't their robot. It's an alien robot.
Don't know.
We don't know. We'll find out, won't we?
What is that?
Ooh.
It's okay.
Will.
He's with me.
Danger, Will Robinson.
Oh, yeah, baby. Oh, my
you may
goodness.
Not be safe here.
Oh, there goes their ship.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Weeks.
We're gonna be here for a while.
Gently.
Who the hell are you?
So the premise of this originally was, it was kind of the Swiss Family Robinson.
There was a rule.
Yes.
But it was sci-fi. They were on a planet. So where's Dr. Smith?
Robinson, so, stick together.
Dr. Smith is...
So we got Mom, we got Dad, we got Penny, we got Will.
John, where are you?
Oh, is that Dr. Smith? There's another guy.
There was like a younger male.
Oh, there's Penny. There's what's her name? She's the new Dr. Smith.
Yes, we have a female Dr. Smith.
Oh, and I like her.
Who's a gender we're not quite sure about.
Oh.
Just as the old Dr. Smith, we really didn't know what his deal was.
He might have been the first gay guy on TV, actually.
And I think he was. He wanted to sabotage the mission, but
yeah,
he got trapped on board.
Yeah.
Yeah. He was a bad guy, but I think he got trapped on board and wasn't at all happy. And he was also really, you know, annoying.
Kind of prissy and.
Yeah.
No, but he was kind of the comedy, you know.
He was always screwing things up. He was, you know, he was the fly in the ointment.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
And it was like, just kill him already.
Yeah,
but no,
really.
they never did.
Never fear.
Anyway,
Smith is here.
The who?
Oh, God. Anyway, so a few weeks from now, oh boy, looks like, you know, we have 10 hours of wonderful fun.
That's going to be a lot of fun. Yeah. The movie was not good, but this might. But they know there's a burden because there's a lot of people our age who have fond memories.
Oh, flush those. I don't care about those. Looks wonderful.
Lost in Space, the reboot.
I just want it to be good so we get more the same way that we get more Stranger Things and we get, you know.
You were disappointed
more...
by Altered Carbon, so this is a chance for Netflix to make good on that.
Yeah, this looks like a healthy family sci-fi drama. So Rick James in Toronto, Ontario, Canada, sent me a note. Mostly, he said, Security Now ASA vulnerability follow-up. Remember that the ASA/VPN, that was the Cisco vulnerability that was initially not, it didn't look like it affected as many people as it looked like it was going to. But later, it turns out that many more of the subsystems had this problem. So anyway, Rick wrote, as I'm sure you and your listeners are aware, Cisco requires its customers to have a support contract to get ASA/VPN software updates. I wonder if this is a circumstance where Cisco needs, all caps, to release a patch like Microsoft did last year to Windows XP, meaning that it's so bad that you shouldn't be forced to have, you know, a maintenance upgrade. I think Rick is exactly right. This makes sense. This is clearly a bad vulnerability. He says, are software/hardware vendors only responsible to fix their security issues if you're a current customer? I thought this might be an interesting discussion since we can't talk to Cisco about it. And then the point of this, well, the thing that brought it to my attention, or the reason I'm bringing it to everyone's attention, since we've sort of discussed this already, is P.S., I had a 2 terabyte drive die in my Drobo Mini last week. And guess what? I ran a level 4, meaning SpinRite, on it. And voila, all is good. SpinRite saved the drive. He says, love the show and your efforts. And then he says, cough, bootable Mac SpinRite, cough. And so, yes, that's, as we know, that's on the way as soon as I get Squirrel behind me. And that's... close to happening too. So thanks, Rick, for reminding our listeners that even though you have a Drobo, you can still have a drive go bad. SpinRite can bring it back for you. And Leo, we got some closing the loop stuff, and then we will talk about the Memcached attack. Let's take our last break.
Yes, indeed. Our show today brought to you, speaking of security, by the Ring Video Doorbell. Its mission to make neighborhoods safer. And the Ring Video Doorbell lets you see and speak to people at your door. They say intruders, but it doesn't have to just be intruders. On your smartphone from anywhere, you can even share video clips with neighbors using the Ring app. I love that. That's the Ring Safe Neighborhoods feature. They actually did this in a Southern California neighborhood. They gave a bunch of Ring Video Doorbells out to the neighborhood. It wasn't... to 100%. It was about 10%, 1 in 10 houses. But that was enough that
crime in that neighborhood reduced by more than half. That's just an idea of what Ring can do, not just for you, but for your home. I always like going to, and I might do this right now, just to see what's new, the Ring Twitter feed, because they put video from actual Ring doorbells of people getting caught in the act. Stephen was in Germany, says this, when a stranger, when Ring caught a stranger looking outside his California home, but with the footage caught on Ring, it was easy to notify the police right away. How about that? I guess they were stealing his chickens. Here's some package thieves. Look, they're going through a package, an Amazon package. He got a motion alert. Let me see if I can put the audio on this. Because
hey, get away.
The kids go, whoa, he's here. They ran. They took off. And then apparently ran the wrong way because the kid comes back.
Sure. Rings up. I rip it open my box.
Oh, did he hear you?
He ran.
Oh, no.
I love it. I just got a big box from Ring. The new Ring spotlight cams. I'm going to put them around my house. I realized what I can do is replace the old outside lighting from the house with these new spotlight cams. I don't want to open the box, but they're right over here. And what you do is they look like the old, you know, old school, you know, floodlights, the motion activated floodlights you put on the side of the house. But first of all, they're LEDs. So they're not only brighter, they last forever, right? And then attached to it is a camera, high def, speaker, microphone, and alarm. And you'll get a notification when anybody's out back there. You can speak to them. You can chase them off. If they don't go, when you say, get out of there, you press the alarm button, 110 decibel alarm, that is guaranteed to get them out of there. Ring has just also introduced, I'm really happy to say, a full home security system. I think what you need to do right now is go to ring.com/security now and take a look at the Ring of Security kits. They put together a number of kits for you with your choice of the Ring Video Doorbell or the new Ring Pro Doorbell and 1, 2, or 3 floodlight cams. And you can save up to $150 off, but you have to go to ring.com/security now for that discount. ring.com/security now. We got Ring, I think it's been a couple of years now. I put it in myself. It was easy to do. And now, man, the funny thing is, and maybe this is the case, I haven't had to use it. And maybe just the fact that it's there, I don't know, but it's great. I mean, I use it sometimes when people come to the door dropping off kids or leaving a package or, you know, we're waiting for a refrigerator delivery today, but I had to drive Michael to school. No problem. I just made sure my phone was set to, you know, the sounds were on. And if the guys came to deliver the refrigerator, I could say, I'll be right there. I'll be back in 5 minutes. I'm just dropping off my kid at school. It's things like that, that once you get used to that, you never want to go back. Visit the Ring Twitter account. It's a lot of fun. Twitter.com/ring and go to ring.com/security now and get your $150, up to $150 off a Ring of Security kit. Ring your house with Ring. And in fact, you might want to send it to friends and family. Incidentally, I think you probably saw Amazon just bought Ring for $1 billion. We don't know how much. And I think this is just the beginning. I think Ring, with some of that Amazon money, I can't wait to see what they do. They have some really smart people there. And Amazon's committed to give them full autonomy. They're just going to have money to do some new cool stuff. So we'll be watching with interest. Ring.com/security now. All right, Steve. Let's give the rest of this a little bit of
closing the loop, yes, with our listeners. Regarding that, the bill that was threatening to pass in Georgia to outlaw anybody who accessed a computer without authorization, Joel Odom, he said, the bill in Georgia that you mentioned on Security Now is effectively dead thanks to the hard work of EFF and the security community, such as those of us at Georgia Tech. Thanks for bringing it to my attention via the podcast. It turns out Joel is a Georgia Tech computer security researcher. So good news that didn't get off the ground, because that was just – we can't have that precedent. That would really be bad. And so Ned Griffin said, hey, at SGGRC, enabling Quad9 DNS on my router, but the few discussions I've looked are pointing people to changing in their computer setting. I have control over all PCs on my network, so am I right to assume the change at the router is okay? I know we've sort of confused things in the last couple of weeks because we've talked about all the variations on that. So I wanted to just clarify for Ned and anybody else, yes, the normal default for Windows machines and actually computers in general, you know, iOS devices and Macs and, you know, Linux boxes, everybody uses DHCP, meaning that they ask the router, which is this DHCP server, for the DNS address. If you then set the router so that it provides the Quad9 DNS IPs, all the systems in your network will just synchronously get it next time they boot. And at least in Windows, if you inspect the IP addresses, you can, if you want to, bring up a console window and do ipconfig, ipconfig, and you might need to say slash all. I don't remember if you don't say slash all, if it shows you DNS addresses or DNS IPs, but definitely if you say ipconfig space then forward slash all, that will give you a dump of the current IP configuration, including what IP addresses for DNS your machine is currently using. That's just a quick way of verifying that your system is getting them from the local network's router. And that is the default. So it almost certainly is, unless you've done something to manually override it. Jared Komorowski said at SGGRC, your description of how Bluehost could securely use the last four of a meaning four characters of a password to verify account ownership is exactly correct. They store two hashes at password creation. I confirmed with some Bluehost quality assurance engineers that I know. Keep up the good work. So I guessed correctly. It made sense that that's the way you would do that. It's kind of the only way you can do that is to capture it at the time that it's being hashed. So I forgot to mention that this looked like I saw the screenshot that I had referred to. I looked at it again after last week's podcast. It looked like somebody was online in a text conversation, like on a web page, asking for the last four of the password just for ad hoc identity verification. So that's what the application was somebody saying, hey, to make sure you're you, just give me the last four characters of your password, which, you know, it's not super secure. It, as I said, it does weaken the rest of the password because it's easier to guess the last four, very much like it's, you're able to guess the two halves separately. But still, as a simple way of asking somebody something that they would know that somebody else wouldn't know, and that you wouldn't have to separately write down, like, you know, the name of your favorite pet or your first pet or your favorite teacher in high school, who knows? That's a nice way to do it. And finally, two people on pronunciation of German or Germanic names, Martin Badke said, speaking long ago with a German interpreter, she explained in German, quote, when two vowels go walking, the second does the talking.
Oh, that's handy. Good to know.
As a teaching phrase. And then he says, D-I-E-B-O-L-D is said with the E, thus D-bold. And he says, consider Einstein and Siemens. Okay. And that's interesting because it's E-I-N, Ein. So there you're getting the second vowel, the I. And with Siemens, S-I-E-M, you're getting the second vowel, the E. And then also adding to that, Midwest Guru said, Diebold, and I'm now working to pronounce it correctly, is a Germanic name. When E and I are together, pronounce the second one. He also used the example of Einstein and Diedrich, where again, D-I-E-T-R-I-C-H, Diedrich. So anyway, thank you, everybody, for your thoughts and feedback. The picture I have in the show notes is of yesterday's record-breaking attack, showing basically a timeline of prior attacks. One, and I can't quite read, it looks like maybe it's 2001, can't see it, but it's, anyway, it's 24 gig that it was like, whoa, 24 gig, oh, what? And then a few years later, 100 gig, Leo, oh my God, you know, 100 gig. And then a few years later, 309, oh, three times more. More than three times more than 100, 309. A few years later, now we're up to about, looks like about 2016, 650 gigs. Okay, you know, wow. Now, yesterday, 1.7. Okay, so I could say it as 1,700 gigabits per second or 1.7 terabits per second is where we are. A internet melting DDoS attack. As I mentioned at the top of the show, this is the result of a devastating service being exposed publicly. What's really curious is that this had been noted a couple years ago in some of the Black Hat DEF CON style conferences. It might have been one of the two of those. Someone just sort of noted in passing that, and it may have been that no one thought anyone was crazy enough to have this publicly exposed. But there's a service on Linux platforms called Memcache, or because it's a service, Memcached for daemon, meaning that it's running in the background. It is a very simple, very fast cache. The idea being that because you might have a very complex SQL database query, after performing a complex, lengthy SQL database query, you might want to do some short-term caching. So it could be in RAM or it could be on the hard drive, depending. But the idea being that you've performed some extensive query. You may need it again. You don't want to go back and reissue the query. So you use this sort of this intermediate cache where you use a key or a tag and the data. So it's very simple. You can't do any fancy queries. You can just say, here's a blob stored under this index. And so this memcache says, okay, and it is accessible over both TCP, and yes, I did say both TCP and UDP. Well, we know what that means if it's publicly exposed. The problem with UDP is there is no provision for verifying the source IP of a query. As we've often discussed with TCP, there is the famous three-way handshake. A SYN for synchronize goes in one direction. A SYN with an ACK acknowledging the receipt of the SYN goes in the other direction. And then finally, an ACK acknowledging the receipt of the second SYN makes the third interchange of the three-way handshake. An interesting side effect is that both endpoints have to tell the truth about their IP addresses in order to receive each other's acknowledgments. Otherwise, it doesn't happen. So TCP cannot be spoofed. UDP is used for lightweight internet traffic where you simply say, give me something. Like, give me an IP address for DNS. And DNS is UDP. And DNS has been used in so-called amplification and reflection attacks. It's amplification because a tiny query can generate a large response. So what that means is that an attacker is able to send little DNS queries to a DNS server, which will respond with much larger replies, thus amplification. But because it's UDP, nothing prevents the instigator of the attack, the person sending the UDP packet, from lying about their IP. They put the IP of the intended victim, the target, in the UDP packet so that the DNS server that receives it believes that guy was asking for a DNS address. And so the larger response goes to the victim of the attack. Thus, it is the attack is reflected off of the DNS server and amplified, a reflected amplification attack using UDP. Well, there have been a bunch of different types of UDP services exposed and used over time. They all pale in comparison to this one. DNS kind of has to be exposed to be publicly used, but a DNS server normally is not used by the public. It's normally used by, for example, an ISP's own clients. So it's possible, even with DNS, to lock it down so that it will not respond to random public queries from the internet, because that's where an attacker would be trying to bounce their bogus query off the DNS server in order to attack somebody else. So you can lock down DNS. This memcache normally would never be publicly exposed. You wouldn't want it to be publicly exposed. The idea is that it is used as an intermediate cache for things that an active system is doing. So the first attack, the first big attack that got everybody's attention was about 4 days ago. And there was an attack on GitHub, not because probably anybody was mad at GitHub, but just they wanted to attack somebody big. And so this was a 1.35 terabit attack on GitHub. In their engineering blog, GitHub said the attack originated from over 1,000 different autonomous systems. Wow. Across tens of thousands of unique endpoints. It was an amplification attack using the memcached-based approach that peaked at 1.35 terabits per second via 126.9 million packets per second. So these are large packets. They're full-size 1,400-byte packets because this is memcache trying to answer somebody's valid query for data that it has cached.
You know what impressed me was how quickly it was mitigated.
Yeah,
that blew me away.
Yes, yes.
And that's Akamai's. That's Akamai's DDoS protection.
Yes, they have a strong DDoS protection. And then yesterday, we saw an even bigger one that broke that record. That was the biggest ever seen, 1.35 terabits per second 4 days ago. Now we're at 1.7. So, okay. What is this? What's going on? So there is a site where this software lives, memcached.org, memcached.org. And they say, introducing themselves, what is memcached? Free and open source, high performance, distributed memory object caching system, generic in nature, but intended for use in speeding up dynamic web applications by alleviating database load. Memcached is an in-memory key value store for small chunks of arbitrary data, strings, objects, whatever, from results of database calls, API calls, or page rendering.
A lot of PHP sites use it. My old WordPress.org PHP-based site.
Well, Leo, get this. YouTube, Reddit, Facebook, Twitter, Wikipedia, Microsoft Azure, IBM Bluemix, Amazon Web Services.
Oh,
I mean, it is a highly used, very popular tool because, as you said, it's there, and it allows, you know, there's very often a slow process to pull something together, which may be re-requested. And so what happens is you're able to set a certain size of the cache. It is an MRU, a most recently used cache. So if you keep asking for something over and over, that stays at the front of the list. Something that doesn't get re-requested ends up getting pushed off the end, you know, getting pushed out of the cache in favor of more recently requested things, and those things tend to stay there. So, I mean, if you've got lots of RAM and you can commit a chunk of RAM to this in-memory cache, then it can speed up your system. It's the problem is the server is normally meant to be bound to the local host IP. So it will and it's running on port 11211. So it's a well-known port. That's where the service lives, and it's supposed to be bound to port 11211 on the local host IP. So only on 127.0.0.1. But in some instances where you have a cluster of systems, maybe you do want to make it more widely available. So it is unbound from that particular IP, and it operates on the interface that the system is using. Unfortunately, some of those interfaces, those network interfaces, are public. And a recent query of our old friend Shodan reports 87,811 open memcached servers. The final picture in today's show notes shows the result of a search for the product memcached returned by Shodan on February 26th, showing 25,000, the majority of them, 25,000 of them in the U.S., just shy of 20,000, 19,647 in China, 4,000 some in France, 3,500, a little more than that in Japan, almost 3,400 in Hong Kong, and so on. So there are 87,000 of these on the internet. And what happens is the bad guys are able to, because it's an open server, you're able to fill them remotely also. So the remote attackers are creating single huge blobs so that a single query is able to return like a megabyte of data. They're able to return massive queries. So not only are they open, UDP thus can be spoofed, but they will accept for caching from the public anything that you want to store there, subject to cache expiration. But if it's a large blob, you know, a megabyte blob, and then you are constantly asking for it over and over, you're going to keep it from expiring out of the cache. That is you, the attacker. The attacker is going to keep it from expiring out of the cache by continuing to ask for it while they're attacking somebody. So this is not good, Leo.
Yeah.
This is not good.
So this is not an exploit in the sense that there's a flaw in the code. This is actually how it's designed to work.
Yes. it was never designed to be public facing. That's the problem. No, by no means would you want to offer your RAM on your server to the public.
So these are misconfigured Memcache servers, right?
87,000+ yeah. of them.
Okay.
Yes. Misconfigured. And notice that your own system's performance will drop if the bad guys use your Memcache RAM for their own purposes, because your valid pages and so forth won't be cached any longer. They'll just get pushed out by this blob, which is being used to attack somebody else. So it's not in your interest to have them exposed. It's using your bandwidth, which you're probably paying something for, and it's using a lot of bandwidth. But it's not clear how we're going to fix this. You know, once again, notice that the only way these attacks can occur is if an ISP is allowing packets not bearing an IP on their network to egress out onto the public internet. Once again, we've discussed this. It's the lack of egress filtering. There is absolutely no reason why UDP packets should be lying about their source IP as they leave an ISP's network. Simply blocking those packets would cause them to be dropped, and then that network could not be used for attacking. Now, of course, the argument is, well, yeah, but everybody else's could. It's like, well, yes, well, we have to start somewhere. And unfortunately, no one is preventing IP address spoofing. It's just, anybody pretty much can do it. I've seen some reports of some ISPs doing it, but obviously not all. So, boy, we have a massive new capability. And it's not clear. I mean, the problem is there's no authentication. This is a get a packet, send a blob. Get a packet, send a blob. No authentication on this protocol. Again, the idea being it was never meant to be public. It was meant to be an internal use, tag and data store for quick storage. The whole point of it is to be fast. It does run. It can run over TCP, but it also answers to UDP. And it does so with devastating effect. So, wow.
Interesting. I have a feeling. The mitigation is, first and foremost, people should just fix their freaking Memcache servers.
Yes.
Right? I mean.
Yes. Oh, now, here's the good news also. The IP of the inbound attack, that's the actual IP of the Memcached server. That is, the bad guys can spoof their IPs, but the attack traffic
doesn't.
It's
the server, yeah.
So it's the IP of the server. So it is possible to identify and potentially to go, knocking on someone's door saying, "Hey, by the way, could you please bolt down your firewall? Yeah. Block port 11211." Because you're attacking people all over the internet. And it would behoove people to do that, too. Yeah, so it's in their best interest.
Yeah, but also,
on the other hand.
Yeah, I mean, it sounds like also their internet service providers should stop allowing outbound traffic.
Yep.
Actually, no, because the outbound will appear to be from the Memcache server. So they can't do that, right? The outbound will be from a legit IP address.
Yeah. Let's see. I think you could argue that there is no reason for Memcache
UDP packets.
Yeah. Exactly. Yeah. There's no reason for any Memcache traffic to transit outside in the world.
Right. Right.
Yeah. Wow.
Very interesting stuff. Now, what do you make of this fast mitigation? I mean, if that's one thing we've gotten better at.
Is
surviving DDoS attacks. I get what they just throw a lot of bandwidth at it, right? I mean,
well, remember that they know that the traffic is going to be inbound from port 11211.
They block that.
So if they're a huge network and they've got automated border controls, they can see a massive incoming traffic coming from port 11211 and just say, okay, block that, shut it down.
Nope.
But still, no small company is going to be able to do that. I mean, and this is very burdensome. That's a massive attack.
No kidding.
So, and there's now that this news is out, there's nothing to prevent all the botnets, all the IoT malware. This is not a remote execution attack, so you can't infect something and then close the back door behind you. These are open servers that anybody who wants to can find and use.
Wow.
Until this problem is mitigated. So that's not going to happen anytime soon.
Steve, another fascinating episode. Of course, all the things you do are great, but I always love hearing the mechanics of these kinds of very big news story attacks and why it's a problem and the mitigation, how simple it would be for people to fix it if they just would sit up and pay attention to what they're doing. As always, very informative. That's why we want to all make sure and tune in every Tuesday for Security Now.
While you keep me around, Leo.
1:30 p.m. Pacific, 4:30 Eastern. We spring forward this weekend in California. So as we enter daylight saving time, that means we're going to record what will appear to be an hour. Oh, don't know. Math is so hard.
Danger, Will Robinson.
Our clocks go forward, but UTC does not. So it'll appear that we are recording an hour earlier. All I know is we're going to UTC minus 7, which means 18:30 UTC. You can do the math.
And there's something about losing an hour of sleep. I'm not sure where that happens.
That we do that as well.
Go to sleep earlier, and then you won't.
I hate that. tune in if you want to watch live to twit.tv/live. And you can also, by the way, join the chat room. Always a lot of fun in there, irc.twit.tv. They're talking about what's happening on the live stream. So the conversation will make more sense if you're watching the live stream. You can watch it on demand, of course. Steve has a full, beautiful transcripts along with the audio version of the show at his site, grc.com. And while you're there, it might behoove you to pick up a copy of SpinRight, the world's best hard drive recovery and maintenance utility, and all the freebies Steve offers, and learn about Squirrel because it's coming soon. And there's so much stuff there. It's actually a treasure. It's one of those places, the web used to be full of this, where you would find a site and spend hours just reading all the stuff there. It's like that. grc.com. We have audio and video of the show. I don't know why you'd want to watch it, but you can. Well, I know why. For the trailers, the movie trailers. There was always a great, or TV trailers. There's always a great TV trailer in every show. go to twit.tv/SN for Security Now, or subscribe in your favorite podcast application. We're there. We're everywhere. This show's been going on for a long dang time. 653 episodes.
Coming up on not quite yet, but the end there. Of year. We're in year 12 now, so
amazing.
Getting there.
Amazing. Thank you, Steve. Thank you, everybody, for watching and listening, and we'll see you next week on Security Now.
Thanks, Leo. Security.